This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So I've got a banter item. It's a couple weeks old at this point. But there was an article in Madison.com, the Capital Times, that was going around a few weeks ago on problems at the Wisconsin-Madison Soc Department. And the article was actually focusing on, you know, steps they'd taken to address them. But it described it as kind of a, that there had been almost like a culture of sexual harassment there, that, you know, things that there were, it specifically mentions both multiple grad students and faculty, not being appropriate. And that sort of thing. So let me just read the first paragraph. Whispered warnings among women in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Soc Department. Senior male faculty making promises about book co-authorship or shared research data while making sexual advances on graduate students. Sexual misconduct by male PhD candidates. All were included in a recently compiled rundown of sexual harassment incidents in higher ed. So, you know, that's obviously not fun to hear. Especially, I mean, I've never, actually, this is one of the programs I've never even visited. But, you know, I still know a lot of people who are from there and, you know, were either faculty there or grad students there, and it's a top department and, you know, a lot of people. And so it's kind of discomforting to hear about, you know, one of the like flagship departments of your discipline.
So that, wait, that Wisconsin story, it comes out, that comes out of like a database of general harassment, sort of like a shitty media men list.
Yes.
But for the Academy, right?
I believe so. I've never seen that, but that's my understanding.
And it was like it was a Madison outlet looking into the local school, because I saw plenty of CUNY entries on that database.
Oh, you've seen it? I haven't.
I think it links through. Like, this isn't just a Madison. This is like an industry-wide thing.
Uh-huh.
And I guess Madison's coming to reckon with it, maybe a little faster than other places, but... Because you got to know, you got to think it's a pervasive issue. Well, you can look up the database, and you can see how pervasive it is.
Yeah,
that database, like 1,000 lines.
I think it had like 3,000 or something when I last checked. Actually,
our hands aren't clean in this business, so it's not a Madison thing. It is an industry wide thing, but so stuff was going on at Madison, huh?
Yeah. So I can speak to that a little bit, and I'm comfortable speaking about my own experiences, but it was very interesting for me to read. And actually the way that you just described it, I mean, you were reading from the article, Gabriel, talking about this cultural sexual harassment at Wisconsin. Something that I've been more open about in recent years is that I left Wisconsin after my fourth year, and I didn't step foot in the state until I came for one practice job talk, and then after that for my defense. And one of the reasons why is because I had experience with persistent harassment and stalking behavior when I was there from one of the graduate students, who I don't know if it's on the list or not, actually. But I guess, you know, there's like a couple of things I want to say, and obviously this is difficult, but I think it's important to say because so many people experience it. And one is that when there was this huge spike in attention, largely because of remarkable undergraduates around the country who were protesting against their experiences with sexual assault on colleges, there was a lot of work paying attention to Title IX for undergraduates. And I think Seamus Khan has a book coming out. There's an article in The New Yorker that was just writing about it on precisely this issue. In summer 2019, the book is supposed to come out. And I felt very angry when I saw this happening, because I just kept thinking, there's nothing here about graduate students. And yet, if that list, or if the Me Too PhD hashtag is any indication, or if my experiences, not just with this one incident, which required me calling the police multiple times, going to a trial, filing a restraining order, and not feeling safe returning to Wisconsin, but also experiences with harassment doing field work, experiences with just sort of that whispering, knowing which faculty to avoid and things like that. That was very real. You know, I guess it's just, it's upsetting because graduate students are especially in this liminal space where they are students and employees of the university. And when it happened to me, I had absolutely no idea what resources there were. And I didn't tell anyone about it. I was, I left to do my field work. The harassment continued from a distance. It continued after I returned to the U.S., and when I finally told the chair about it, which I told because I found out that the student was doing the same thing to other graduate students, I was sort of passed off to the Title IX office and no one ever spoke to me about it again. And that, I realized that there are certain things you can and can't do, but it was sort of the lack of support after learning how endemic this was and then learning more and more in the years since, that has been especially frustrating for me.
So if there's any graduate students who are listening who find themselves in a similar situation, what should they do? Or what advice could you give them?
You know, it's harder for me to give advice. I'll give advice to graduate students in a second, but I actually want to give advice to faculty now that I'm faculty at a university, because the few people who knew about it, that I left Wisconsin and never came back, and no one ever asked, how are you doing? How's it going? Can I do anything to make sure that you succeed in this program? Can I do anything to make sure you stay connected even though you're not here? That would have been really helpful as opposed to just totally brushing it under the rug. There was a time when I reached out for advice because we had a restraining order. I had to go to ASA. I was on the job market and I found out this person was going to be at ASA and I didn't know what to do because I didn't know if the restraining order carried over into conferences. I asked the chair of my department, who said, call ASA. And to me, that was terrifying as a student. And I called ASA and they said, call the hotel. And the hotel said, well, you can check in under a pseudonym. So that's what I did. It was really fucked up, to be blunt. And I was terrified the whole time I was on the market. And thank God for my friends, because they made sure I was never alone, because I was just very afraid to be alone. I was afraid of getting harmed. So it would have been helpful to have faculty reach out and know that this was happening, or the ones who knew that it was happening, because many didn't. My own advisor, I don't think he knows even now. This is not anything we ever talked about, but it would have been helpful to have encouragement to tell my advisor. It would have been helpful to have support to know that I wouldn't have been ostracized as, you know, a woman dealing with emotional issues, which is what I was terrified of being ostracized for because of this, but instead to know that I had the full backing of the department to continue doing my degree from a distance and that I didn't have to be ashamed of what happened and keep it secret.
Yeah, I mean, I think tell your advisor is, you know, it's obviously not the only thing somebody should do, but it's definitely, that's not somebody who just signs off on your papers. I mean, it's somebody who's supposed to be kind of your guide through the degree program. And so they really should be, you know, there to help with the problem, you know, and also to figure out any accommodations that are necessary. So, you know, you don't have to tell them everything if you don't want, but just at the very least, just tell them I'm having a problem. I need help with it. And then it's kind of up to you. Tell them how much.
It's important for advisors to create a space for that sort of thing. And this actually goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about working 60 hours a week. If you make it seem like you yourself are a machine with no relationships or emotions or other things outside of work that matter, then it can be very hard for students who are dealing with major issues outside of the purely professional aspect of the PhD to offer up information about them without being afraid.
Well, you know, that's why I always distinguish between having an advisor and having a mentor, right? It's kind of like your advisor is like, that's like purely like you're connected, like we're going to co-author and there need not be any emotion between us at all, right? So it's all transactional. And your mentor is someone who's your guide, right? And I think that there are some people who are better suited to being good advisors, right? And some who are better at being good mentors. And I think it's very rare to see someone who's good at both.
What should departments do, though, if they know a member is creating a hostile work environment and it gets to the point of restraining orders? It's a bit surprising that that person would be allowed to stay.
I mean, I can say very clearly, this was one thing that was frustrating for me, is that there was a trial. The person was required to leave temporarily, and no one knew. The person's advisor didn't know. Other faculty didn't know. And so one thing that was hard for me at the time was that I left for my safety and security and mental stability. That person left because they harassed and assaulted two women. And there, you know, there were multiple witnesses at the trial. But to the outsider, we both just left to finish our degrees, you know, and I think that was actually kind of frustrating for me, that it just seemed like many other people who leave to write their dissertation, that we were just deciding to write from a distance, and that actually those decisions weren't informed by some very serious things that had happened while in the program.
Yeah, with this issue of like, what should departments do? You know, when you take the sexual harassment training that I know Elisa and I have to do every 2 years online, it's basically just 4 hours of kick it up the chain, kick it up the chain, kick it up the chain, right? Yeah. I mean, that's it. Don't try and solve it yourself. Hand it over to the experts. If you try and deal with it yourself, you're liable, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a very, and then likewise, there's, you know, all sorts of issues around retaliation, not only with the, you know, the person complaining of abuse, but also of the person who's accused of it. And so, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, things that you're supposed to keep it private. So some of what we're talking about are kind of constraints that, you know, the Title IX office itself, driven to a certain extent by, you know, case law and liability concerns and that sort of thing, puts on departments. There's limits on what departments are simply allowed to do, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, much as you might like to say, we should kick, you know, tell this person's advisor about, you know, scumminess and kick them out of the program, a department or an advisor isn't always allowed to do that.
So, you know, so that article, I can't remember who brought up the piece in the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Was it you?
Yeah.
Okay, now, Elisa, you brought up the New Yorker piece, and you're right. Like, you know, I kind of feel like all of these initiatives are pretty much all undergraduate driven. Mm-hmm. And I think a large part of it is because, I mean, you know, universities have that whole in loco parentis thing, right? Yeah. Like, they're totally there. They're actually supposed to actually sort of serve as like these absent parents in some way.
Not in the state of New York, but go on.
And so, yeah, so there.
No, I'm serious. So go on though. Sorry.
Right. So there's that whole in loco parentis thing. I don't know about the state of New York, but you know, whatever. I do remember, like, when I was an assistant master at Princeton, like we talked about this in loco parentis thing all the time. And here, like at Georgetown, we also talk about this. And whereas with graduate students, there isn't the same thing. And I was just wondering, like, and thinking about that article where, you know, you have these faculty who are working in conjunction with undergraduates and with some graduate students and with staff to see what sorts of little things, right, could you shift about the culture of an institution? In this case, maybe the culture of a department, mm-hmm. right, to try and try and just to make graduate students safer. Because I mean, so I'm on this presidential task force that deals with sexual assault and misconduct at Georgetown. And it's true. Graduate students, at least they are a subset of the groups that we're looking at, right? And that's one of the things that we're trying to figure out. Like, what could be done? I mean, there's this weird thing, at least I don't know if it was like this for you in grad school, but it was like, you know, it's like almost all of the faculty are male, right? And people talk about the sort of networking and socialization that happens outside of the classroom, which is very often at the gym or having drinks or what have you. And if you're a woman and you don't want to be shut out of that kind of networking, what do you do, right? And would maybe trying to change something about little things about that culture or about these situations that we find ourselves in as graduate students be enough to help that? I mean, maybe not in your case because you had a stalker who was another graduate student. But
well, you think, you know, one thing that's happened since these articles have been published in Wisconsin is so many of my friends and I are speaking out about our experiences. And we're speaking to each other about them too. And it's heartbreaking because, yes, I have very clear memories of starting graduate school in Wisconsin, being told, watch out for these faculty, not knowing why specifically, but just knowing that these were things I needed to be careful, or people I needed to be careful around. But after that, I was like, you never talked about it again. And now there's sort of an opening where people are sharing their experiences. And if you want to change a culture, you have to at least know what's going on. And the culture of silence around sexual harassment and assault in graduate school leads to the idea that there isn't a problem. This other graduate student who's listed in the spreadsheet, who recently graduated, who assaulted multiple women and is the reason why they formed this committee to talk about sexual harassment in the department. The fact that he graduated with a PhD from one of the top countries in the department absolutely sends a message that you can do this and maybe you'll get a slap on the wrist, and who will ever know about it, you know? And these people might be at ASA or other conferences. These people might be publishing in our top journals. You know, obviously we are having the same question when we look at Hollywood and the media. Do you continue listening to Chris Brown's music, which they played in my fitness class the other day? And I was like, do I walk out, you know, or people who are known assaulters, do you continue to see Woody Allen movies? Things it's very complicated, but I think to change the culture, you have to talk. And that's why, it's been so important to me to at least speak out about my own personal experiences, even though I can't necessarily, I don't think it's right to talk about others at this moment in time.
Sure, of course. That way, I just want to give a different perspective on the idea of dealing with it, because in our system, we are regularly told that legally the students are adults. And if someone who I knew and cared about found themselves in this situation, my immediate reaction would be get a lawyer and send the lawyer to the school to deal with this. And I guess it's an issue if some people just don't have the wherewithal or might not have the family help. But do you guys know of any legal outreach or programs that if somebody finds themselves in this situation, they can get the help of a lawyer? Or do you think the lawyer idea is a bit aggressive? Like, that'd be my inclination. Like, we could talk about culture change and whatever, but nothing gets an institution moving as quickly as potential liability.
And honestly, it's just terrifying. When you're in this situation, the last thing you want to do is draw more attention to yourself and to it, knowing full well that it could jeopardize your entire career, right? So it's really scary to take those steps. And that's why I think... I mean, one thing that I think would be helpful is not just for all of us to have sexual harassment training, but actually for like a pamphlet to be handed out to graduate students the first day or the first week or whatever in ProSem, listing all the resources they have, both on-campus resources and maybe outside campus resources, if anything ever happens to them.
So I have a question about this culture issue. So there's two ways to think about it. It seems like Wisconsin sociology had an above average number, not just of incidents, but of perpetrators. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I mean, UCLA has had problems. There was kind of a scandal involving somebody, I believe, in history who it was kind of a serial skis.
Yeah.
And but I'm wondering, like, when you have multiple perpetrators, what is it? Is it how much of it is either A, you know, you have independent events, right? You know, every member of a department has a, you know, 1% chance of being a creep, and then you aggregate over that and you get a Poisson distribution for the number of creeps, right? Or, and then how much of it is that there really is kind of a culture of impunity, or even a culture of encouraging it? Another way of asking that is, did Wisconsin as a department, was it wicked/negligent, or was it just unlucky?
I feel like I can't answer that because I left so long ago that I don't know what it feels like to walk those halls without feeling afraid because of my own personal experience. Sure. But I don't know. I mean, it's also tough. I mean, you have to think about it. It's a really big department. Yeah. It's a really small town. Very few people who are on the faculty have ever left. It's not one with a lot of turnover in that sense. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that.
Do you have a final word, Elisa? Or?
Yeah, I want to add one more thing because we didn't talk about it, but a lot of sexual harassment graduate students that has not been mentioned happens while doing field work. And it really affects your ability to do research. And it's something that happened to me, and I have spoken about it elsewhere, but I actually want to just point to a great article that came out in Sociological Forum in 2017 by Rebecca Hansen and Patricia Richards, and it's titled Sexual Harassment in the Construction of Ethnographic Knowledge, because I do think that's a missing piece of the conversation about what shapes largely women, but also men's trajectories when it comes to research and succeeding in graduate programs insofar as sexual harassment is concerned.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.